Please turn in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 10 as we continue our study through the prophecy of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 10, we'll be looking at verses 5 through 19, dealing with the nation of Assyria. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5. Oh, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury. Against a godless nation I send him, and against the people of my wrath I command him, to take spoil and seize plunder, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. But he does not so intend, and his heart does not so think, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he says, are not my commanders all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose carved images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her idols as I have done to Samaria and her images? When the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will punish the speech of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the boastful look in his eyes. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding. I remove the boundaries of peoples and plunder their treasures. Like a bull, I bring down those who sit on thrones. My hand has found like a nest the wealth of the peoples, and as one gathers eggs that have been forsaken, so I have gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved a wing or opened the mouth to chirp. Shall the axe boast over him who hews with it? Or the saw magnify itself against him who wields it? As if a rod should wield him who lifts it, or as if a staff should lift him who is not wood? Therefore, the Lord Yahweh of hosts will send wasting sickness among his stout warriors, and under his glory a burning will be kindled like the burning of fire. The light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. The glory of his forest and his fruitful land, Yahweh will destroy both soul and body, and it will be as when a sick man wastes away. The remnant of the trees of his forest will be so few that a child can write them down. So reads the word of the living God. In 2023, Hasan Bitmez, who is a member of the Turkish parliament, addressed that body with a fiery speech against the nation of Israel, in which he denounced the nation of Israel and pronounced judgment on it. And he finished his speech by saying, quote, even if you, meaning Israel, escape the torment of history, you will not be able to escape the wrath of Allah. And those were his last words. At the age of 53, immediately after he finished speaking, he had a massive heart attack and fell down dead in the middle of parliament. Now, regardless of your thoughts on the modern Israeli state, that is a demonstration that God hates pride. God hates pride. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 13. Pride and arrogance and the way of evil and parroted speech I hate. Proverbs 6, 16 and following. There are six things the Lord hates. Seven that are an abomination to him. And the first, haughty eyes. James chapter 4, verse 6, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And because God so abominates the sin of pride, because it so militates against his chief end, his own glory, pride is therefore, for us, utter insanity. Not only is pride a delusion and a falsehood, it is a self-destructive fallacy. Pride is suicide. You don't believe me? Just ask Nebuchadnezzar. Ask Uzziah. Ask Hezekiah how pride worked out for him. Ask Satan. Ask Sodom and Gomorrah. In your own life, when has an arrogant tone ever made your relationships better? When has pride ever built someone else up? When has it ever actually improved your condition of life to address someone in a condescending way? No, pride only destroys, and yet we cling to it as if it could give us life. Pride defies the glory of God, and therefore it defies all joy and love and life. Therefore, to boast is to write your own eulogy. Arrogance is insanity. And that's what Isaiah meant to teach Israel with the illustration of the boasting of Assyria. This section begins in Isaiah chapter 7 and stretches all the way to Isaiah chapter 12, beginning with the pride of Ahaz. Ahaz, the king of Judah in the south, unwilling to ask God for help. Instead, he says, I've figured this out on my own. I'll appeal to, of all people, Assyria to save me. God says, that's not going to work out. I'm going to give you a sign, and also Assyria is going to come, and they're going to destroy you. They're going to be a bee that I whistle for from the end of the earth. They're going to be like a river that I summon to flood all the waters of Judah up to the neck. The unbelief of Judah, the folly of Israel, and last week we saw the continued anger of God against the unbelief of his people. And eventually we'll see in the next chapter the salvation that will one day come through the branch, through the descendant of David. But in the middle here, we have this pronouncement of a woe, not only against Israel, but now against the one he calls in chapter 9, verse 11, the adversary of Rezin. God turns his attention to the arrogance of his chosen instrument, Assyria. And the structure of this passage is fascinating, as is often the case in Isaiah. You guys have been with me since the beginning, so you've seen all the very intricate ways that Isaiah can put a passage together. This one has a chiasm in it that's then followed by sort of a conclusion. Just show you this, the structure of verses 5 to 15. This is a chiasm, meaning it has sort of like an X shape if you were to map it out. There's parallels at the beginning and the end, and then sandwiched in the middle all the way to something that's right in the center, which is usually what the emphasis is supposed to be. And you may have already even noticed it. At the beginning, you had some mention of Assyria as a rod, as a staff. You have that same thing in verse 15. And then you've got these two sections of Assyria boasting, where these are words either that are assumed to be spoken by Assyrian kings or actually were. We don't know. But these boasts on the part of Assyria, and then right in the middle, verse 12, where God says, well, here's what I'm going to do because of that boasting. And then verses 16 to 19 are really just a follow-on to verse 12. Okay, what is that judgment then going to look like? When he visits their sin upon them, what's it actually going to look like? It starts with therefore, so it's sort of the conclusion of the whole thing. And the central point of this whole passage is that pride, arrogance, boasting is absolutely insane. It makes no sense and is only going to lead to destruction. I'll put it this way. You boast at your own risk. You boast at your own risk. And the first part of this that we're going to see, looking at the brackets in the chiasm is that pride really is absurd. Pride is absurd. Look with me at chapter 10, verse 5. He begins, "Ah, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury." Assyria. The nation of Assyria has shown up already in the book of Isaiah, but we need to take a few minutes, I think, to back up and understand who are we really dealing with here? Because we're going to continue to see this nation over and over again in the book of Isaiah. Who are we talking about? In the Hebrew, Ashur, it first is mentioned actually in Genesis chapter 2, verse 14. It wasn't there in the Garden of Eden, but is mentioned as being next to the Tigris River. And then you get into Genesis chapter 10 and 11, and you see this figure, one of the sons of Ham named Nimrod. That's a great baby name. Nimrod, who is the first of the mighty men, and he founds Assyria. He founds Babel as well, several other nations in that same area. And he's the one who founds the cities that become the mainstay of Assyria, which is important because that's going to be basically the profile for the nation of Assyria all the way through. It's all about power. It's all about might. It's all about being strong and stronger than its adversaries. That's why Micah calls it, Micah chapter 5, verse 6, the land of Nimrod. There are a number of Assyrian kings going thousands of years back, but just in the more recent history here, you had Ashur-dan III, who's one of the Assyrian kings. He's probably the king during the time of Jonah. He likely was the king who got saved through Jonah's preaching. There's actually ancient Assyrian records that mention a time when an Assyrian king named Ashur-dan III did not go out to war for about 8 years, which was very unlikely for them. Then you've got a handful of others. Pul mentioned in 2 Kings 15, 19, who's probably Ashur-nirari V. He's the son of Ashur-dan. He exacts tribute from Israel. 2 Kings 15, 29, you find Tiglath-Pileser III, who is probably the Assyrian king in view at this moment that Isaiah is writing. He's a particularly barbaric king. He captures Galilee. 2 Kings 17, 3, Shalmaneser V. 2 Kings 18, 13, Sennacherib. Isaiah 20, verse 1, Sargon II. And 2 Kings 19, 37, Esarhaddon. Those are all the ones that are mentioned in the Bible. They're followed by three others whose names I can barely pronounce. And then eventually Babylon comes in and destroys them utterly. Assyria, a lot of these kings are named Ashur something because that was the name of their main god, Ashur. He was the chief god of the Assyrians, and they believed that this god had ordered them to expand their territory because all the rest of the world was just chaos. So what they needed to do to really help everyone out was expand their empire and bring it under the dominion of Ashur so that they could bring order to that chaos. And when the Assyrian kings were installed, they were believed to be commanded by Ashur to go on a great ritual lion hunt because they saw lions as sort of the preeminent beast, the figure of this chaos. And if they could tame a lion and kill it, then certainly they could do that for the nations. So that's why you see Assyria talked about a number of times in even biblical literature as a lion. These were some particularly powerful people. You can see even on this map, this is about as big as their empire gets, massive over the ancient world. We're dealing with a time frame in between those two, so it's somewhere in the middle. Their capital there in Nineveh. And they are particularly brutal people as well. Tiglath-Pileser III was known for all kinds of brutalities. Ashur-banipal II, who came before him, he would put his enemies on pikes, he would skin them, and then he would hang their skins on the wall. Tiglath-Pileser III, this guy would cut off people's noses, cut off their ears, cut out their tongues. Their method of warfare wasn't, hey, we want to conquer this place and then repopulate it ourselves. It was, we want to decimate this land to send a message. We want to strike terror and fear into the hearts of everyone else. So Shalmaneser III, another earlier king, his conquest is depicted at the Balawat Gates. This is a depiction from those gates. I'm sorry, not that one, this one. You can see here, he cuts off people's hands, their feet, shoves people on poles, hangs their heads on gates. Pretty gruesome stuff. Esarhaddon wore enemy heads as a necklace. That's why Nahum describes Nineveh as, quote, the bloody city. It's just utter brutality. Xenophon describes the Assyrian armies as dressed in blood red. And they liked to be feared and thought of as brutal. They invented a form of sandal that wrapped up to the knee, and on the bottom of it were spikes, so that when they defeated their enemies, they could tread on top of them and their blood would ooze between their toes. That's how vile and wicked these people are. And I bother walking through all that so that you feel the weight of what God is saying in verse 5. Assyria, the rod of my anger. The staff in their hands, all that brutality, God says, that's my fury. I did that. That's an astounding statement, isn't it? How is it that God could say something like that? Well, first of all, the language here, the rod, it's used for a lot of different things. Probably here thinking about the rod for a weapon of punishment, of discipline. The staff, often a weapon of war, but also the staff of a ruler, a scepter. He's saying whatever power they have, whatever sovereignty they have that they're using to bludgeon their enemies, it's my fury that they're actually exacting. Here, of course, he's referring to Assyria's role as his instrument to bring about destruction on the people of Israel. That's what he was just talking about in the previous verses. He talked about how they're going to be destroyed. They're not going to rejoice over their young men. Nobody's going to have compassion. Their wickedness is going to burn like fire. And he even said back in chapter 9, verse 11, the Lord raises the adversaries of Rezin, Assyria, against him, and they devour him with an open mouth. So the point that he's getting at here is Assyria, this horrific, wicked nation, is doing God's will. They are accomplishing God's purpose. And he's using the image of the rod and the staff. He says, verse 6, against a godless nation I send him. That godless nation, by the way, is God's own nation. It's Israel, the northern kingdom. That's what he called it in chapter 9, verse 17. Everyone is godless and an evildoer. He said, I send him to that nation. And against the people of my wrath, I command him. It's strong language. This is not accidental. God is saying, I sent him there. I told him he had to go. You may think, well, so did God appear to, we'll just call him TP3, Tiglath-Pileser III. Did God appear to him and speak to him in a voice? No. No, that's not what happened. But he commanded him by providence. The unstoppable eye of providence is always God, isn't it? Notice the emphasis in this passage. I hope you could hear it. My, I. God is claiming responsibility. I did this. To take spoil and seize plunder, the Meher Shalal Hashbaz, Shalal and Baz, that's these words. The spoil and the plunder, to tread them down like the mire of the streets, to walk all over them like clay, like mud. God says, I'm responsible for that. God claims that he's the one who sent them. So you have to ask some questions then, right? I thought God was of purer eyes than to look on evil. I thought God was not himself tempted by sin and did not tempt anyone to sin, James chapter 1. And yet here he's saying, I sent a wicked nation to do wicked things. And just to put a further stamp on it, This is not the only passage in the Bible that has hard truths like this. 1 Kings chapter 22, you remember Ahab gets together all of his false prophets, wants them to prophesy to him. And then Micaiah, the one true prophet, gets called up. He says, sure, whatever, you'll go win. He says, no, don't tell me what I want to hear. Tell me the truth. So he says, okay, fine, I'll tell you. I saw the throne room of God, and I saw a bunch of spirits proceeding in front of the throne of God. And one of them, a lying spirit, came out, and God said, who's going to go be a lying spirit for me in the mouths of the false prophets? And the lying spirit, a demon, says, I'll do it. And he says, go, do it. So God apparently commands even demons in their tempting work. Or Job chapter 1, you're all familiar. Have you considered my servant Job, Satan? God is the one who starts the conversation. And then Satan says, well, let me tempt him. God says, he's in your hands. Do you know that the Bible says that the greatest act of evil that mankind has ever committed, God himself was sovereign over? Acts chapter 4, verse 28. Speaking of the death of the Son of God, the Gentiles and the Jews were gathered together in Jerusalem, and they only did what your hand predestined them to do. That's just in the Bible. I didn't make that up. These are just Bible passages. There's a lot more. It's just some of them. Where God is claiming a kind of responsibility of a sovereignty over sin. So how do we make sense of that? Well, verse 7 actually gets us a little bit closer, I think. It helps us out a little bit. Look at verse 7 here in the text. It says, but he does not so intend, and his heart does not so think, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few, just to cut off a lot of nations. But what God is saying is that as Assyria is doing its evil deeds, what's in his evil heart is evil, which is different from what's in God's heart. God has a purpose that superintends their intention. Do you notice the parallel? His heart does not so think, it is in his heart to destroy. Meaning, it is in my heart to use them as a rod to discipline my people. This word for intend, it's the word for likeness. He does not compare himself that way. He doesn't think of himself that way. He doesn't think I resemble a rod in God's hand. He doesn't conceive of it like that. Instead, he has his own plans. He thinks he's working for Asher, his god. He thinks he's going to get rich and lots of land. The word there, but, in the text, but, it is in his heart to destroy. It's really just the word for. It's not in his mind and in his heart to do the will of God. It's in his heart to do the opposite of the will of God, to do sin, things that God condemns. God obviously condemns the wickedness of the murder of his people. And yet, God also uses that sin for his purposes. This language, his heart does not so intend or so think, it's the exact same word that's used in Genesis chapter 50. Remember with Joseph and his brothers, Joseph's brothers throw him in the well. Eventually he ends up saving them. He says, Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, what you meant, intended, thought for evil, God intended for good. That means God superintends evil intent. John Piper has a quote from this book that I think is helpful. He says this, quote, these spectacular sins do not just fail to nullify God's purpose, they succeed by God's unfathomable providence in making his gracious purpose come to pass. There's a lot in there, but one thing I just want you to appreciate is his phrase that he uses there. It's an important one. He says, unfathomable providence. If you are to ask the question, how is it, like metaphysically, how does it work? You're using the language God is sovereign over. That's fine Bible language. But what does it mean? Like, how does it work that God is saying, I'm sending you, but you're choosing freely to do evil? I didn't create the evil in your heart. I didn't make you sin, but I'm sovereign over it. How does that actually work? And Piper's answer, which I think is a good one, is mine, which would be, I don't know. I don't know. It's unfathomable. In fact, that seems to be Isaiah's answer as well. Look at verse 15, which is the parallel here at the other half of this. Shall the axe boast over him who hews with it? Or the saw magnify itself against him who wields it, as if a rod should wield him who lifts it, as if a staff should lift him who is not wood? He's saying, the way that you need to think about the distinction between God and mankind, particularly a wicked nation that God is using for his purposes, is the same kind of difference between an inanimate axe and someone who wields it. It is a category distinction. Axes don't think. Axes don't do. They don't purpose. They're just here he says wood. So there's wood and there's not wood. There's God and there's not God. He's saying, you're not gonna understand how those things work together because you're not God. You're just another one of those tools, one of those instruments. This is like Isaiah later, he's gonna say, can the clay talk back to the potter? Why'd you make me like this? You realize you're just out of your league. It's essentially God's answer to Job, isn't it? Job chapter 38. I'm sorry. I'll wait. Were you there at creation? No. Go ahead. Tell me. No, you're out of your league. There's a sense in which this is a question we don't have the ability to answer. And that is why it is so absurd. I mean, the picture he gives you in verse 15 is supposed to be comically absurd. An axe, talking to the guy holding the axe, the lumberjack, being like, no, don't do that. It makes no sense. It couldn't do that. It wouldn't do that. It's impossible. It is a mysterious kind of sovereignty. And therefore, if an axe decides, I'm going to boast over him who hews it, here he's thinking, Assyria is not just boasting in general. He's boasting against God's people. He's saying, I'm going to go destroy your people, God. And God's like, yeah, because I sent you. You see how foolish that is? How absurd it is to try to shake your fist at a sovereign God whose sovereignty is over your shaken fist and is purposing it for his ends? Erasmus and Luther had a fiery debate in the 16th century about the nature of free will and sovereignty and all of that. And Erasmus wrote a book called On the Freedom of the Will. You can guess where he landed on that. Luther wrote The Bondage of the Will. Here's how Erasmus thought about this. He said, quote, what is the point of praising obedience if in doing good or evil works, we are the kind of instrument for God that an axe is to a carpenter? But such a tool are we all, if Wycliffe is right. Like, did you read Isaiah 10? Yeah, we are. That's exactly what he just said, Erasmus. I think Luther has it right instead. He says, quote, a man without the Spirit of God does not do evil against his will, under pressure, as though he were taken by the scruff of the neck and dragged into it. God doesn't make someone sin, but he does it spontaneously and voluntarily. It's out of our own nature that we sin. Tiglath-Pileser III, he had a sinful heart and he acted according to his sinful nature. God was sovereign over it in some mysterious, unfathomable, providential way. He purposed it. I think often our trouble with this is because we just can't see God. That's why Samuel Rutherford says, quote, do not focus your thoughts among the confused wheels of secondary causes. Look up to the master motion of the first wheel. In building, We see hewn stones and timbers under hammers and axes, yet the house in this beauty we do not see at the present, but it is in the mind of the builder. It is hard to believe when his purpose is hidden and under the ground. That's why this is so mysterious to us, because we don't see how sovereignty works. And yet it does. That's exactly what this passage is saying. It does. God is sovereignly working all things according to the counsel of his will, and that includes evil Assyria. If there's an exhortation that Isaiah is giving to Israel here, of course, this is written in Hebrew. It's not really written to Assyria. It's written for God's people. If there's an exhortation here for the people of God, it is pay attention to who is really in charge. It is so easy for you to take your eyes off of him and put them on what Rutherford called the secondary causes, all just the stuff happening in the world. And Isaiah is saying, look up at the person holding the axe. Pay attention to him. And pride will become so clearly absurd, so obviously foolish. Well, first, pride is absurd. Oh, this is a picture of an Assyrian axe, in case you're wondering. That's what it looked like. This is from a couple centuries before this. Secondly, pride is blinding. Pride is blinding. Not only is pride insanity, but to be proud makes you foolish. It blinds you to the truth. And we see this played out in the two arrogant boasts from the mouth of the king of Assyria, verses 8 through 11, and then verses 13 and 14. Look at verse 8. He says, for he says, are not my commanders all kings? Like, all the guys that I put in charge of my military have done such a good job, and they've conquered so many people, all of them have just become kings over their own territories now. And he's going to list some of them. Is not Calno like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? And you're like, yeah, like that. What are we talking about? We're talking about cities that are kind of on a north-south stretch from Assyria down into Israel, all the way into Samaria. This is, I know it's not terribly clear, but you can kind of get the idea of it. This is the best picture I could find that delineates kind of the path that he's following there in his mind. And the idea here is the Assyrian kings have conquered these nations. They've conquered these cities. They've destroyed them. They had their own gods that they prayed to and that they fully expected would protect them. And then Assyria came along and said, I will take your land and your people. Thank you very much. And destroyed them. So he says, well, if I was able to do that to them, what hope does Jerusalem have? What hope does Samaria have? He says, verse 10, as my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols whose carved images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria. I don't know exactly what that means, that they were greater, bigger, maybe. They had bigger idols than Jerusalem ever had, bigger than the golden calves in Samaria, maybe. I don't know. Greater somehow. Listen, I defeated the stronger people. So don't you think, verse 11, I'm going to do that to Jerusalem and her idols, as I have done to Samaria and her images. Yeah, there were idols in Jerusalem at this time. There were high places where idols were still worshipped, certainly in Samaria as well. It seems like he's talking about this destruction of Samaria's past tense. That may be a reference to some of the incursions earlier on into the northern kingdom. My sense is that he's just talking about a future event as if it's already done. But the point is, either way, listen, I've destroyed all these other people. Of course I'm going to destroy you. This kind of boasting of military might. Ashurbanipal II, who's an earlier Assyrian king, he boasted this way. He said this. In strife and conflict, I besieged and conquered the city. I felled 3,000 of their fighting men with the sword. I carried off prisoners, possessions, oxen, and cattle from them. I burnt many captives from them. I captured many troops alive. I cut off some of their arms and hands. I cut off of others, their noses, ears, and extremities. I gouged out the eyes of many troops. I made one pile of the living and one of the heads. I hung their heads on trees around the city. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I razed, destroyed, burnt, and consumed the city. So you want to know what trash talk sounds like from Assyria? This is it. This is an actual surviving document. And that's what it sounded like. Listen, I destroyed all those others. So what do you think is going to happen to you? And then he goes on boasting in verse 13, by the strength of my hand, I have done it. Interesting now, God was asserting himself as the chief player here. Now he's turning it around. I have done it. Interestingly, that word done shows up in verse 11 as I have done, but then verse 12, when the Lord has finished his work, what he has done, same word. God's not impressed by what he thinks he's done on his own strength. By the strength of my hand, I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding. It's not only that I got a lot of troops, big, strong army, it's also that I have all the stratagems. I know every military play in the playbook. I remove the boundaries of peoples, he says, and plunder their treasures like a bull. I bring down those who sit on thrones. This rapid fire, three verbs. I remove, I plunder, I bring down. He's just heaping up praise for himself. Look what I can do. Taking away their land, taking away their treasures, taking away their kings. In a way, he's saying, I'm in charge. All these other nations think they are, but I am. Verse 14, my hand has found like a nest the wealth of the peoples. And he's creating sort of a word picture here. I assume he thinks it's funny. I found like a nest the wealth of the peoples as one gathers eggs that have been forsaken, so I have gathered all the earth. So he's picturing like a bird's nest that's been deserted by the mother bird. And so there's just eggs sitting there, and you just go in and you grab it. He's saying, as easily as you do that, that's how I conquered the whole earth. This is nothing for me. This is easy. And there was none that moved a wing or opened the mouth to chirp. No, Mama Bird came back and she didn't even cry about it. She's like, I don't want to mess with him. It's a way of saying, all the gods are powerless before me. Really, what this is deification. He's saying, I am God. I am God. That's what he's saying. It's a kind of self-deception, isn't it? I did all this by myself. I did it, as Sinatra might say, my way. You know what's so interesting? 1 John 1:8. If anyone says they don't sin, he has deceived himself. That's such a scary place to be. If you have deceived yourself, how would you know? You deceived yourself. He's blinded himself because of his own pride. Thomas Watson says, quote, pride is a complicated evil. It is spiritual drunkenness. It flies up as wine into the brain and intoxicates it. You can't think straight when you're prideful. You can't see anything the way it actually is. All of a sudden, you think you're God. You imagine you are God. Romans chapter 1, verse 22, they became futile in their thinking and claiming to be wise, they what? Became fools. Totally self-deceived. I'm as wise as God is. Wiser even, in this case. This is essentially how atheists talk. Thomas Huxley, 1825, he said, quote, the supernatural is being swept out of the universe in the flood of new knowledge of what is natural. It will soon be as impossible for an intelligent, educated man or woman to believe in God as it is now to believe that Earth is flat, that flies can be spontaneously generated, that disease is a divine punishment, or that death is always due to witchcraft. Basically saying, no smart person would believe in God. We know too much now. Pride makes you think that self-determination is everything. That your whole life, all it comes down to is whatever I can do. And really, you should get the credit for it, honestly. John Milton, a Puritan, wrote an epic poem entitled Paradise Lost, and he was reflecting on the fall of Adam and Eve, some 13 or so chapters. And he's thinking about what would be happening in the mind of Satan. It really starts once Satan has fallen, but it's sort of Satan reflecting on his own fall. And it's a way of thinking about the nature of sin and pride. And so I'll put the quote up here. I'll explain it. This is Satan in John Milton's language in Paradise Lost. He says, "What though the field be lost? All is not lost. The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate, and courage never to submit or yield. And what is else not to be overcome? That glory never shall his wrath or might extort from me. To bow and sue for grace with suppliant knee and deify his power, who from the terror of this arm so late doubted his empire, that were low indeed. That were an ignominy and shame beneath this downfall." In other words, what he's saying is, you know what God can never take from me is my own will. He can throw me down into the depths of hell, but I still chose it. God says, did you? Or were you enslaved? Enslaved to your own sinful desires and your foolish pride? You know, the last thing that a sinner might think as he steps into an eternal lake of fire is, well, at least I chose this. And God says, no, you didn't. You were enslaved to it from the beginning. You had no other option because you were so consumed with pride. Isaiah's point here is that pride is blinding. It makes you think you're God or something like him. So if pride is blinding, then the antidote is sight, isn't it? It's to see something truly, to see it really, to see God for who he is, to see yourself for who you really are. To see how needy you are. You realize 8 hours a day on a good night, you're totally defenseless. You're just laying there, dead to the world, doing nothing. Your brain is barely active, you know? And you think you're in charge? How many things can't you do? How weak and feeble are we? And then to, you know what I deserve? People should treat me this way. You don't get to talk to me like that. Listen, you're a sinful sack of flesh. The only reason we have any worth is because of God himself. Because of his grace being made in his image. We need to see who we are and then see the brilliant holiness of God. That's what cures us of the blindness of pride. But that's not where he ends this. Third, he said, pride is deadly. Not only is it absurd and is it blinding, but pride is deadly. It's not going to end well for the proud one. And this is what he gets at in verse 12. He says, when the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will punish the speech of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the boastful look in his eyes. Again, that word work is the same word as the word done in both verse 11 and verse 13. King of Assyria says, I've done it. God says, that was my work. I was sovereign over it. And notice it says, when the Lord has finished all his work. So all that Assyria is doing, which is really accomplishing God's purpose of bringing discipline to his people, all that Assyria is doing, he's got a purpose for it. He's got like an end in mind. When he's finished, he's doing something with it. It's got an end date. When he's finished all his work, which seems to be a reference to the conquest of Samaria in 722 BC, when Assyria finally does take the northern kingdom, wipes it out entirely. When God is done decimating the northern kingdom, and then goes all the way down to Mount Zion in Jerusalem, comes up to the neck of them. This is what we're going to read eventually in Isaiah chapter 36 and following, where Hezekiah's on the throne and Sennacherib comes and he sends the Rabshakeh and he's threatening him. And when all of that happens, then God is going to turn his gaze away from his people and towards the implement that he used. He's going to bring judgment to the wicked nation that he used to bring judgment on the wicked nation. This is very much the same pattern that you see in the book of Habakkuk. You remember Habakkuk says, God, why is there so much wickedness in Judah? And he says, I'll take care of it. I'm going to send the Chaldeans. I'm going to send Babylon. They're going to destroy Judah. And he's like, whoa. The Chaldeans are worse. Why would you send them? And God says, well, I'm going to judge them too. I'm a perfect judge. I'll judge all sin in my time, in my way. So he says, when I'm done using you for my purposes with my people, then I'm going to punish the speech. The word punish is the word for visit. And the basic idea here, it's used the same way in Exodus chapter 32, is I'm going to visit their sins upon them. The thing that they have done, I'm going to bring back on their own head. It's a very justice-oriented term. Whatever they've done, they're going to get exactly what they deserve, right back on them. What is it that they've done? Interestingly, to God, all the barbarism, that's not the greatest stench. It's the arrogance. It's the pride he can't stand. He will punish the speech of the arrogant heart and the boastful look in his eyes. There's these two kind of interesting idioms in Hebrew. The first literally is the fruit of the greatness of heart. Someone thinks they're really, really great in their own heart, and what comes out is arrogant speech. So it's a good translation, I think. And then the second one, the boastful look in his eyes, literally the beauty of the height of his eyes. This is a unique idiom to Isaiah, but I think the point is well made in the ESV translation. The boastful look. He has arrogance in his gaze, not only in his speech. And part of the point of constructing the sentence this way is to emphasize just how deserved this judgment is. This is exactly fitting. This is precisely what he deserves because of his arrogant heart. And what's that going to look like? Well, jump down to verse 16. Verse 16, he starts to describe in greater detail what this judgment's going to be. He says, therefore, because all that's true, the Lord Yahweh of hosts will send wasting sickness among his stout warriors, and under his glory a burning will be kindled like the burning of fire. Here he's describing the fall of Assyria, probably in multiple stages. He's going to use two images, the image of disease or of sickness, and then the image of fire, both of which are just destroying either a body or a land, but two images to describe the kind of judgment that God is going to bring on the nation of Assyria. Notice he calls himself Lord Yahweh of hosts. It's an exalted title. I'm in charge of all the armies, in case you're wondering, particularly the armies of heaven. He calls himself the light of Israel, verse 17, which will become a fire. God is a consuming fire, but he's also a light. To his people, he gives light. To his enemies, he burns. And his Holy One, a flame. And it will burn and devour. Holy One, transcendence, otherness. and it's going to burn and devour his thorns and briars, probably a reference to the Assyrian army. And it says it will all happen, verse 17, in one day. One day. This is a big nation. One day. My sense is that he's probably here referring to what we see in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 36, when Hezekiah, surrounded by the armies of Assyria, looks toward heaven in humility and prays. It says, God, please save us. So you know what God does? While the Assyrian army is gathered outside the gates, he sends one angel. The angel of the Lord comes, and 185,000 Assyrian warriors are dead in a night. Where's your boasting now? Just like that, one day, they're gone. The text says, and in the morning they went out, and behold, dead bodies everywhere. But that's not the end of it. Verse 18, the glory of his forest and his fruitful land, Yahweh will destroy both soul and body. Here he's pictured as a forest having captured all the trees of Lebanon and from all the other nations. He's going to bring their utter downfall. Now, the downfall of Assyria is prophesied and described all over the Old Testament. Jeremiah describes it. Ezekiel describes it. Micah describes it. Zephaniah, Zechariah. Verse 19, here it says, the remnant of the trees of his forest will be so few that a child can write them down. There's an instance in Judges chapter 8 where Gideon has a young, maybe child, young man, write down the number of people surviving from battle, and he can count up to 77. I don't know how high this kid can count, but it's not a lot. The point is, it's barely anything's left, totally decimated. Do you know there's a whole book of the Bible that is dedicated to describing the destruction of Assyria? It's Nahum, the book of Nahum. It's three chapters, it's a minor prophet, describing the utter destruction that God will bring on the nation of Assyria, its capital being Nineveh. Nahum is very descriptive in his language. He says this in Nahum chapter 1, verse 14, Yahweh has given a commandment about you, speaking to Assyria, no more shall your name be perpetuated. All those boasts, they're going down. From the house of your gods, I will cut off the carved image and the metal image, and I will make your grave, for you are vile. Do you know that's exactly what happens? After the 185,000 are killed in the night, Sennacherib goes back to his house, and he's in the house of his God, and one of his sons comes and kills him. Makes his grave right there. It's exactly what Nahum says will happen. God takes him down. Nahum chapter 2, verse 10. Desolate, desolation and ruin. Hearts melt and knees tremble. Anguish is in all loins. All faces grow pale. Where is the lion's den? The feeding place of the young lions, where the lion and the lioness went out, where his cubs were, with none to disturb. The lion tore enough for his cubs and strangled prey for his lionesses. He filled caves with prey and his dens with torn flesh. He's saying, oh, you did really well conquering all those nations. But now, verse 13, behold, I am against you, declares Yahweh of hosts, and I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall no longer be heard. Woe to the bloody city. This judgment is coming. Why? Well, you know why. Proverbs 16, 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. I suggest to you, maybe just as a acronym, PBD, pride before destruction. Remember that? Whenever you're tempted to be arrogant, prideful, PBD. PBD. Pride goes before destruction. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6. You know why you can't make new converts elders in the church? So that they don't get puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil.
Satan was prideful, condemnation. Another cure for pride, Isaiah is telling us, is to see its end from the beginning.
Where's this going? Where's this going to take me? It's not going to take me where I want it to take me. It's not going to give me the glory that I really think it will.
Where will this pride lead? Eventually, it's going to lead to the lake of fire. This is the language in Revelation chapter 18 describing the destruction of Babylon, the great city of the Antichrist. Revelation chapter 18, verse 7, as she glorified herself, pride, glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see. For this reason her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. Pride is deadly. If only we would believe that. If only we would believe it. So what hope is there? That God humbled himself. Mankind, we can be humbled. We're not particularly good at humbling ourselves. But Philippians chapter 2, verse 5 says, have this mind in yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a slave. And he became obedient. He humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death. And it's for that reason that now his name is exalted above every name. And every knee will bow. Jesus says, he who exalts himself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted. How do you humble yourself? You go to Jesus. You run to the humble King who accepted a fate he did not deserve that prideful sinners do. And you say, Jesus, let me have your mind. Pride will only lead you into further insanity, only further into condemnation. But Jesus can lead you to life.